Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega today. And coming up on The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 2nd, we're talking evictions and a new push by the CDC to help folks who would otherwise lose their home. And we're talking with you about it.
I'm going to need that money or I'm going to be going negative.
We've missed a few payments, but we're getting by.
The Senate's foot dragging has been, quite frankly, pissing me off for a month now.
It's like putting chewing gum in a crack at Hoover Dam.
Plus, while Ed Markey rode a progressive wave to victory in Massachusetts, Joe Kennedy III became the first Kennedy in history to lose a primary in the Commonwealth. We'll talk about what it means. And the fashion industry reckons with racial justice.
It matters because fashion is also a business that very directly shapes our ideas about who people are and how we want other people to perceive us.
On Tuesday, the Trump administration announced an initiative that could potentially spare millions of people from eviction. According to the new rule, renters earning less than $99,000 cannot be evicted before the end of this year if they don't make rent because of the economic slowdown. The order was issued by the CDC, citing the agency's authority to control the spread of COVID-19. It comes after weeks of congressional inaction on rent and eviction relief. So, the big question is, will it work? And how big of an impact will it have? We're going to talk about it, but I wanted to give you the first word here at 877-8-MY-TAKE. How has your housing situation been impacted by the pandemic?
My name is Heather from Stanton, Virginia. So during the pandemic, I filed for Pandemic Employment and Assistance Program, PUA. I still have not heard back from anyone. Our mortgage company has been lenient with us. We've missed a few payments, but we're getting by. But we have eaten into most of our savings, and if the PUA assistance doesn't come in or no one gets back to me, I will be one of the many Americans that was left on the back burner with no help from the government.
I'm Garth from Brookline, Massachusetts. We've been able to pay our housing. I've been unemployed since March, so it's been working. But the Senate's foot dragging has been, quite frankly, pissing me off for a month now. It's just a disgusting display of political game playing. Unemployment isn't disincentivizing my job search. It's just letting us pay all of our bills.
George Morris, Dallas, Texas. Our lender worked with us to lower our monthly payment due to changes in our income. We've been able to hang in there and haven't missed any payments, but are worried now that unemployment benefits have been sharply reduced while our pay hasn't come back to fill the gap. In Texas, it seems like city, county, and state governments are too busy passing the buck to offer any kind of meaningful help.
Joining me now is Monica Arellano, a managing attorney at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. Thanks for being here, Monica.
Thank you, Arun.
And also with us is Matthew Desmond, principal investigator at Princeton University's Eviction Lab and author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Great to have you on the show, Matt.
Good to be here.
Matt, how big is this eviction crisis we're dealing with? I mean, how many people are at risk of losing their homes right now?
Well, millions, potentially. In an average month in America, over 800,000 people are threatened with eviction every month. So that's like the population of Seattle threatened with eviction every month around the United States. And that's before the pandemic. That's when the economy was supposed to be strong. With unemployment levels that we haven't seen since the Great Depression, with the expiration of federal benefits and moratoriums until the news released just late yesterday, by some estimates, tens of millions of families were at risk of eviction by the end of the year.
Tens of millions. Monica, have you witnessed anything like this?
No, never. This is unprecedented.
This is LA. So you must, in California, it's a huge state, a lot of people who already are have housing insecurity. Is this something that's evident before your eyes?
Yeah, so we essentially have seen an uptick in preparation for what folks are calling in Los Angeles the eviction tsunami, preparing for high volumes of evictions at levels that we've never seen before, and that also tenants are not prepared for. It's something that it's a legal process, and it's something that folks need attorneys for, and folks don't have attorneys.
Right. I mean, Matt, can you explain more, though, about this new federal action? I mean, who is eligible and how many people could potentially be spared from eviction?
Well, when the federal moratoriums came out in the CARES Act a few months ago, they only covered federally backed mortgages or renters that had a kind of housing assistance from the federal government. That covered about a third of all renting households. So it helped, but it left a lot of people exposed to eviction unless their state stepped in. This moratorium is different. This moratorium covers all rental households, but renters in those households need to meet three criteria. There's income criteria. So if you received a stimulus check, or if you make less than $99,000 a year or $198,000 a year as a couple, that's one step in the qualifications. You need to show that you have lost income because of the economic shutdown or because of big medical debts that you've incurred during the pandemic. And you need to express a real fear that you would be homeless or doubled up with someone if you were evicted. Now, if you meet those three criteria, you have to declare that to your landlord according to the CDC guidelines. This is kind of just tenants signing a piece of paper saying, I meet these three criteria, I've declared it to you, here you go, landlord. And that, according to what we know so far, is how it's supposed to work.
I wasn't really expecting the CDC to be, at the center of a process like this. Am I right to be surprised, or is this kind of like par for the course?
This is unprecedented. The CDC has enacted a really interesting statute, and a statute that comes kind of into relevance during a pandemic. So in normal times, I don't think you would see the CDC stepping in to say, hey guys, let's slow down or stop evictions. But during a pandemic this deadly and this serious, it's taken pretty extraordinary actions, and I'm so glad it has.
Monica, do you feel similarly? Does this feel promising from your perch?
Absolutely. It was a pleasant surprise that someone's taking direct action, right? It is an improvement on some of the actions we've seen before. It's not flawless. It is more inclusive. But there's always the reality that it's been 6 months that this has been going on, right? We're going into the seventh month. A lot of tensions have built between landlords and tenants for reasons outside of rental payment and or in addition to rental payment. So it was a pleasant surprise, but there's definitely room for improvement.
And Matt, what are the kinds of hoops that renters need to take advantage of? I mean, is this sort of onerous or do you think it's reasonable?
I think the biggest question I have, and I think that Monica's work in legal aid, probably she sees this every day, is there's a difference between a right on a paper and a right in practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to get the word out. We need to make sure renters know that this new right exists, but we also need to empower renters to exercise that right. And for many renters that I've met over the years studying the eviction crisis and housing insecurity, there's a lot of fear out there. There's a lot of misinformation. And so I think that this is a first step, but another immediate next step is to make sure people know about this and make sure people feel comfortable going to their landlord and saying, hey, I have this eviction protection now. Can we figure something out between now and the end of the year?
Monica, he referred to misinformation. We have enormous, powerful interests that are all watching this play out, perhaps could benefit from misinformation. Is this something that you're seeing play out in the communities that you deal with?
Absolutely. We get a lot of phone calls that say, you know, I got an eviction letter or I got an eviction notice, but there's a moratorium, so there's nothing for me to do, right? There's big headlines that say eviction moratorium federally, eviction moratorium on a county level, on a state level, and it really is misinformation. As Matt was saying, it's one thing to have a law that protects folks, but if there's no one to enforce that law, if there's no one to raise this defense, if tenants can't effectively articulate these things, or if landlords don't know either, right? Sometimes landlords don't know that they have responsibilities in these laws also, then it's relying upon multiple parties to engage and effectively execute these laws in order for them to have the impact that was intended.
California did squeeze through its own eviction moratorium the last minute earlier this week. Does that moratorium still apply in the wake of this federal measure?
Yes, it does. So the federal measure was released not very long ago. So it's still being reviewed and analyzed, but it does appear that the California law would still apply since the order allows for more protective statutes to stay in place. And arguably the California law is more protective.
Matt, given the enormous interests that operate through pretty much every corner of the nation when it comes to housing and real estate, was there a lot of pushback to this?
There will be a lot of pushback. I think that in several states, property owners have challenged eviction moratoriums already. In those cases, they've lost, and the courts have upheld the moratoriums. I'm confident that this statute will also be challenged in court as well. But I think the bigger picture is that, this is going to save lives. You know, eviction would just spread the pandemic. It would deepen our unemployment crisis. It would complicate school openings. And so, you know, there is going to be challenges. And Monica's right. This isn't airtight, and it certainly only delays eviction. It does not prevent them. And a big question is what happens at the turn of the year when the moratorium lifts. But I think that this is an incredibly important step in terms of getting the pandemic under control and giving renters that breath of relief that they deserve to feel.
Monica, some critics have argued that eviction bans unfairly favor tenants at the expense of landlords. Landlords claim that, you know, without their rent payments, they can't make their mortgage payments or pay property taxes. What should we make of this argument?
Well, I think this is one of the few times where tenants and landlords are actually on the same boat, right? They're on the same side. The issue is really that there's a bigger systemic problem, right? Both renters can't pay their rent and some landlords can't pay their mortgage because they depend on the renters to pay that rent. So I think this is one of those situations where their problem is actually really similar. But as far as the difference is, if someone is renting a property and they're unable to pay their rent and they're evicted, the data has shown they'll become homeless. And if they're homeless, then it really spirals into becoming a bankrupt in life, so to speak, right? Whereas a property owner, if they're unable to pay their mortgage and or property taxes, could potentially lose property, does not lose their actual housing. Mm-hmm. Also, landlords, when they go into renting properties, go into it as a business, right? And when you go into a business, you assess business for risks and you assess business for loss. And people have business loss on a regular basis, and there's plenty of protections for that. There's also some, for instance, in California, the law that passed, right, Assembly Bill 3088, protects foreclosure for units of four or less owned by individuals. So if it's a big corporation that does this on a more massive level, then theoretically they can afford to lose some of those rents without the high levels of impact that the tenants would be feeling with high rates of homelessness.
Right. Monica, recently a friend of mine, Ruben, recounted a really awful story that he experienced years ago. He was a UPS delivery guy at the time, and he was in Midtown Manhattan when someone jumped from the 27th floor and landed directly in front of him and between him and his packages, actually. And he remembers the time of the day. It was 4:04 p.m. He remembers the name of the person, Stella, and he knows why she jumped to her death, because apparently she was being evicted. And what I'm wondering is, as you watch all this play out, do you get the sense that Americans do recognize the seriousness of this crisis?
Yes. My answer is yes. I think when an individual's in a position of despair, of fear, and especially in places like Los Angeles, where the levels of homelessness have just skyrocketed, and it's prevalent everywhere, it's visible everywhere, and sometimes people aren't used to this, and they see it, I think that the feeling is very real, and it's not abstract, and it's not happening on some governmental level remote from them. It's in their homes very literally. It's about their housing very literally. And I do think Americans are very well aware of the reality that could exist when someone is evicted.
Meaning someone else as well, using that the society at large does recognize, I mean, because we've been hearing about congressional inaction and all that, albeit we have federal orders happening, but you do think that the society at large does recognize how bad this is?
Absolutely. 2008 was not that long ago. And I think folks still know what that feels like, what it feels like with uncertainty, with economic dips, with inability to pay not just your rent, but a lot of the bills, and also what that feels like, right? The identity and emotional process that is connected to that. And I think that even if you're not the person directly experiencing it, you do have a connection to what others are going through. And I think one of the things the pandemic has highlighted is our ability to connect as human beings and to understand the struggle of others. So I do very much think that Americans are aware and hoping and willing for action.
Matt, did much change since the 2008 recession in terms of helping people manage this kind of housing insecurity?
No, the opposite happened. So rents continued to rise. The cost of utilities continued to rise after the 2008 crisis. But incomes for many Americans were flat or they fell in real terms across the country. So there was this shrinking gap between what a lot of families were bringing in, what they have to pay for basic shelter needs. And then we didn't have much action from Congress. We didn't have an expansion of public housing or housing vouchers, for example, that allow people to only pay 30% of their income to rent instead of 60 or 70%. And so we've gotten a situation today where the majority of renters below the poverty line are spending at least half of their income on housing costs. The situation has gotten worse since the last housing crisis, not better.
I mean, and we hear about so many possible ways of addressing these problems in certain cities like New York, or say the Bay Area. We hear about housing, I guess, a lack of housing supply. We also hear about sort of NIMBY approaches, like we don't want people to be building lots of buildings in our community, in our backyard. We hear about the president suggesting that the suburbs should not allow, you know, low income, you know, I guess, code for people of color tenants to come into their communities, all these obstacles. But for you, given the gravity of this, what are the kinds of things that we could hopefully see emerge from all this attention we're having on the housing problem?
Now that we have an eviction moratorium in place nationwide, the next step is to figure out what to do about this giant pile of rental debt that has built up since March. Many are calling for rent relief, the kind of action from the federal government to kind of pay off that debt. Many other housing organizers are calling for a canceling of the rent. And what they're doing in that call is to say, we need to help all families, not some. And we need to push this burden off families who are incredibly stressed and under severe conditions to property owners and ask them to petition the state for relief. So there's a lot of calls right now. We also have someone running for president in Joe Biden who has a housing plan that would expand housing vouchers to all families who qualify for them. That's a game changer. You know, most families who qualify for this incredibly important anti-poverty program, they don't qualify for that help just because we don't have enough to go around. And so that would be a game changer as well.
Monica, we have a little more than a minute left. Is there anything else you want to add to that in terms of what you hope will happen in the coming months, especially given that we have a presidential election right around the corner?
Well, I think right now is a time for hope. There's a feeling in the air that anything can happen at this point with all that's already happened in 2020. And we do see some effort. The state of California did make an effort to switch the rental debt over to consumer debt, but it has its flaws again, with the ability to still collect in small claims, potentially garnish wages. And it's just really passing the buck, and it's really shifting the problem instead of solving it. So really looking forward to someone actually building affordable housing, giving people equally access to that housing, and really seeing a change for the impact that housing has on people's stability, on their health, and just a whole sense of societal health.
We'll have to leave it there. Monica Arellano is a managing attorney at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. And Matthew Desmond is the principal investigator at Princeton University's Eviction Lab, and also the author of Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Erin from Napa, California. My answer is yes, the pandemic affected my ability to pay for my housing. Am I facing eviction? No. What is the state doing to help? California is making law to make it impossible to face eviction until February of 21. What does that do to solve the problem? It's like putting chewing gum in a crack at Hoover Dam. This is just bringing a bright light onto a much deeper issue, housing, that's been building for many years.
Hi, my name is Charlie, and I live in Seattle. And throughout the pandemic, I wasn't having much financial problems because I'm a veteran and I was going to school on the GI Bill, which was helping me pay for rent and bills. But now that I separated from the military, living in Seattle is expensive, and I'm really waiting on Congress to put through the next stimulus check, because in October, I'm going to need that money or I'm going to be going negative.
As protests against police brutality spread across the U.S. this summer, major fashion brands and companies expressed solidarity with Black Lives Matter through black squares on social media posts, public statements, and commitments to, quote, do better. Some brands, like Japanese retailer Uniqlo and Nike, pledged to donate $100,000 to organizations that support Black Lives Matter. Others, like Gucci, which has its own history with racism, published a letter stating its commitment to, quote, fight to end systematic racism, bigotry, police violence, and oppression. As Fashion Month begins, physically and virtually around the world, and here in New York City next week, the spotlight is off the runway and onto the business side of the industry. But can these gestures translate into real structural changes across the fashion world? For more on this, we turn to Robin Givhan, Washington Post fashion critic, and fashion designer Tracy Reese, who is the founder and creative director of Hope for Flowers. Robin, Tracy, so glad to have you with us.
Hi, thanks
Great
for having
me.
Robin, before we get into structural changes, please help catch us up on fashion weeks, which are going on all this month. What does it look like this year?
Well, it looks a lot like a lot of people around the world sitting in front of a computer watching live streams and videos and Zoom news conferences. It's quite virtual. I think there will be some live events actually, or at least are planned for this season. But essentially, it's, I think, a really big moment of reset for a fashion industry that, like so many businesses, is in upheaval.
Yeah. How would you characterize overall the response of the industry to what has happened this summer?
I think it's been a pretty fast buildup, actually. You know, it started out with a lot of companies and individuals posting notes of solidarity on social media, and it very quickly ramped up, in part because it seemed that a lot of people within the industry, a lot of black people within the industry, had quite simply just sort of lost patience with mm-hmm. notes of solidarity. Mm-hmm. And there were demands for actual changes that could be measured, from getting more products from black-owned companies on store shelves to opening the doors to more black photographers to shoot cover stories, to changes in boardrooms and in the design ateliers themselves.
Tracy, do you worry that this is just another trend, at least for some brands?
You know, there's every chance that that could happen. And I think, you know, it's up to us as black people in this industry to make sure that it isn't a passing trend or a phase. We have to do the work. We have to make sure our voices are heard. We have to keep the pressure on. We have to hold brands and all these organizations accountable and make sure they follow through with all the pledges that have been made and take it even further.
one would think that the extent to which change is possible depends on the number of people who are Black in a given organization or in the industry overall. Robin, has that changed enough that you think there is critical mass?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, there's been a lot of attention paid to the models that are on the runway, that are in advertising campaigns, in part because they are the most visible part of the industry for so many people. And over the last few years, that has changed dramatically. It's now when you go look at a runway show or you look at an advertising campaign, the company that doesn't have diversity in those images is really is sort of the odd company out. That said, you know, Gucci had a significant problem with a sweater that had gave the appearance of someone wearing blackface. And that sweater caused a stir on social media, and it was the impetus for Gucci taking a really long, hard look at its corporate culture. And part of the reason for that is because Gucci has a very diverse workforce in the U.S., something like close to 15% of its workforce in the U.S. is Black. And, you know, and that reflects the population in the U.S. And yet, despite having a diverse workforce, that sweater went from design concept to product on store shelves without anyone speaking up and even suggesting that it was problematic, which left both the president of Gucci and the chairman of its corporate parent saying, why didn't anyone speak up? Why didn't people feel that, one, if they did speak up, they would be heard, or two, that they could even step out and say something?
And this episode kind of makes me think that this idea of reflection, introspection, and having transparency in terms of how huge corporation actually operates, that this is all kind of contrary to the nature of fashion, which is built around a certain kind of mystique and a particularly crafted image. Is it especially hard for companies like this to do the necessary work?
You know, I think that's a nice out for the fashion industry in some ways. Yes, there is this element of, you know, each designer sort of having this vision of who the person is that they're dressing. And certainly as you get higher and higher and higher on the fashion pyramid to ever more exclusive brands, the audience narrows simply by nature of the financial wealth that's required to indulge in those brands. But fashion is also, it operates in the real world. And it is sensitive to and touched by all the same issues that affect every other industry. And so the idea that it would be either immune or be able to rise above, I think, is something that the industry has cultivated, but clearly isn't really true.
Tracy, give us some insight into how you've navigated the industry over the course of your career.
That's a good question. You know, and as all this has been unfolding these last few months, I've thought about it a lot. And, you know, there are certainly some huge generational changes that, you know, we're seeing. And, you know, I've said this a few times, you know, my generation was the first generation to go to college with a full ride. And, you know, among our families and friends, you know, it was a big deal. And we had a choice of where we wanted to go. And all of our parents worked their way through college, you know, and scrimped and saved and somehow made it through. But they were able to send their children, you know, to the colleges of their choices. And it was a huge deal. And it was a big responsibility, you know, for each of us who got that opportunity to find a way to be successful and to make great use of it. And so our generation was all about, you know, figure it out, find a way to succeed if you have to work around the system because the system is not welcoming to you, then find another way. You know, if a door closes, a window opens, but bear down, work hard, and find a way. And that's the story of my career where, you know, a lot of times people ask me, did you experience racism? And it's like, of course I did, but I did not have time for it. I didn't have time to stop and feel bad about it or complain about it. I don't think my complaints would have been heard or appreciated. It didn't matter. It was just like, find another way to make your dreams come true. And that was the story of my generation and the story of my career. Of course, there were roadblocks and barriers, but I pushed through. And it was really about the work and working hard and showing up and you know, finding a way to be accepted, getting your foot in the door any way that you could, even if, you know, you didn't feel welcome. And times are so different now, and I'm glad of it. You know, today's generation, that's not good enough. It's not good enough just to get your foot in the door. If the establishment doesn't welcome you, then create your own establishment. You know, it's a very different time, a different industry. I think the feeling among young creatives is completely different, and I'm energized by that.
Now, you're on the board of one of the biggest organizations in fashion, Tracy, the Council of Fashion Designers of America. How have they been thinking about this moment?
Oh, it's been huge at CFDA. And, you know, CFDA has been called out from every direction because, you know, it's a symbol of, you know, the fashion establishment, especially in this country. And, you know, there are plenty of people at CFDA who would, and I'm not saying, you know, necessarily organizationally, but membership wise too, who would love, you know, to keep the status quo because it's worked to their advantage. But, you know, CFDA is recognized, you know, as the governing body for fashion in the U.S. And so it has to break that kind of chain of racism that, you know, many people feel is prevalent within the organization and the industry. And, you know, CFDA has to assert its leadership on this as it does in many other roles in the industry. So, you know, we're really bearing down and working hard and trying to attack this from every level and also, you know, work on it in partnership with a lot of the organizations that have been formed these last few months, including Black in Fashion.
Now, we've been talking about how models on runways are the most visible sign of change or lack of change. But behind the scenes often has to do with access to investors or industry resources. Is it too soon to say whether that is changing, Tracy?
It is too soon. And I think that that's obviously the biggest hurdle. You know, when we talk about wealth and we talk about, you know, having a stake, you know, in the foundation of this industry, Black people don't have the stake that white people do, or even Asians, because Asians are very much involved in manufacturing and, you know, and also design, and they have a different stake in this industry, and we don't have a financial stake in this industry. So we're relying on financing from the white establishment, you know, to fund our businesses, or we have to find a way to self-fund, which means we're going to be starting much more slowly with a lot less capital. And it's a long road. When we speak to young Black designers, I help mentor a group of young Black designers at CFDA, and capital is the biggest challenge. Most of them are working full-time jobs and trying to, you know, run their own businesses on their own at night, and they have their own direct-to-consumer channels, and, you know, they're doing double duty trying to launch their brands or maintain their brands, and it's super challenging. And of course, in this climate, ready money, ready capital is not really available. And to be honest, walking into a bank or a factor as a Black creative is not an easy thing to do. You know, they're not looking at you the same as they would a white man or, you know, someone who has, you know, their family wealth or connections. So it's very lonely, you know, trying to launch a brand with very little capital. It's very challenging.
Robin, given all that is happening in the world, why do you think this matters?
Well, it matters because, one, the fashion industry is an enormous global business that we all participate in. And it matters because fashion is also a business that very directly shapes our ideas about who people are. It helps shape who we believe ourselves to be and how we want other people to perceive us. And it also is, you know, it's an industry that really is about creativity and about innovation and entrepreneurship. It remains one of the few industries where, you know, despite all of the hurdles, financial and otherwise, it's still accessible for someone with as cliche as it might sound, with an idea and a dream to actually, you know, make something of it. And I think just sort of fundamentally, it is an industry that, you know, continues to be alive and well in the U.S. And particularly for smaller designers, a lot of the manufacturing that they do happens in the U.S. And so as much as, you know, we talk about the importance of, you know, made in America and supporting American industry, this is an American industry that would be better the more open and supportive it was of designers and creative folks of all colors.
Robin Givhan is the Washington Post fashion critic, and Tracy Reese is a fashion designer and founder and creative director of Hope for Flowers. Robin, Tracy, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you, Arun.
Thank you.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career, but her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And now a headline that's never been read before last night. Kennedy loses congressional primary race in Massachusetts. That's right. For the first time in 27 elections, dating back over 50 years, a Kennedy has lost a primary race. It wasn't even that close. Joe Kennedy III fell to progressive incumbent Ed Markey last night after a contentious race in the Commonwealth. Markey was a co-signer of the Green New Deal and was endorsed by AOC and others on the left, while Kennedy infamously received Speaker Pelosi's endorsement, despite her party's policy on not endorsing primary challenges to incumbents. Also, longtime incumbent Richard Neal, chair of the Ways and Means Committee, bested 31-year-old mayor of Holyoke, Massachusetts, Alex Morse, who dealt with accusations of inappropriate sexual conduct with students when he was a professor. The accusations did unravel, with Morse accusing Neal of coordinating the smear against him. Neal has denied involvement. Joining me now is Adam Riley, a political reporter for The Takeaway's partner station, GBH, in Boston. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Arun.
Let's start with the Senate primary race. It became a pretty contentious race towards the end. So what helped Markey get over the top in a pretty big way here?
The first thing that I think I'd point to is his ability to develop a really passionate base of young voters, and in some cases, people who were too young to vote but were still really enthusiastic about his campaign. He was clearly the favorite of younger voters in this race, which might seem counterintuitive at first because he's an older guy. Kennedy is relatively speaking, young. But Markey, I think, had the advantage of his co-authorship of the Green New Deal. As we know, young voters are especially concerned about climate change. He also had a knack for giving young activists roles to play in his campaign. He made them part of his campaign infrastructure in a way that a lot of people sat up and took notice of. It's not necessarily that frequent for young people to be given key roles, and I think that the young people who worked for and with Markey felt like they had them. And the other thing I'd add, and this is sort of squishy, but I think it's a real factor, he developed a political aesthetic over the course of his campaign that young voters seem to really enjoy and enjoy working with. I'm thinking of, for example, the ad that he rolled out in the campaign's closing weeks, in which he famously inverted JFK's line about not asking what your country can do for you and closed by saying,
"With all due respect, it's time to start asking what your country can do for you."
Mm-hmm. The ad was shot in the style of what I would describe, and I'm no, you know, cinematographer, I would describe it as sort of 70s cop show chic.
Starsky and Hutch.
It was this, yeah, a little bit. You know, with, for example, when you see that Elizabeth Warren endorsed Ed Markey, her face comes up and the shot freezes as very 70s font identifies her underneath. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that young voters are driven by stylistic concerns rather than substantive ones. That's not what I'm saying. But the Markey campaign did do a really good job creating a sensibility that I think people found both inspiring and also kind of fun.
Let's get real here regarding sort of the national optics of this race. I mean, seriously, in the year 2020, does anyone under, say, the age of, I don't know, 35 or 40 actually care about whether Kennedy did or did not win a primary?
That is a great question, and what I'm going to try to artfully dodge as I respond to you. I know that there's already brewing pushback here in Massachusetts from people who seem to dislike the idea that this campaign was a referendum on the Kennedy name. And I think that they've got a point in that it's also a referendum on Joe Kennedy as a candidate. And he, I would say, had a hard time articulating a clear, convincing rationale for his candidacy. He said that Markey didn't show up to meet with his constituents as much as he should have, that he wasn't present enough in Massachusetts. He also accused him of not being sufficiently attentive to issues involving race and racial injustice. And there were times when those critiques seemed effective. But the problem for Kennedy, I think, is that he was making a fierce urgency of now argument, saying we need a new generation of people who aren't Washington insiders. Well, he was also coming from a family that is kind of embodies American political insiderness this race.
Kennedy still receives strong support from the Black community in Boston. So why do you think the Kennedy name still holds weight for voters of color in the state?
I think there's no question the Kennedy family, in particular JFK and RFK, are seen among certain slices of the electorate in Massachusetts as, among other things, civil rights heroes. So the polls did show that among non-white voters, that was one of Kennedy's stronger constituencies. And I do attribute that to his family legacy, the way people think about the work RFK and JFK did, and also to the fact that I think the most effective critique Kennedy made over the course of this campaign was that Markey isn't attuned enough to issues of race and racial injustice. He mm-hmm. put it front and center, and then when you have the memory of the family in the background, I think that's an effective combination. He was trying to get them to come out in, as you know, great numbers as he could, and it didn't. It just wasn't enough in the end.
So in another race, we saw Richard Neal hold on to beat Alex Morse in the first district. How did this play out in terms of establishment versus non-establishment Democrats?
I think in that race, you had much more of a clear anti-establishment line of attack coming from the challenger. Kennedy struggled to make that. I'm not sure he wanted to make that because he is part of the Massachusetts Democratic establishment, as is Ed Markey. It was tougher to make that differentiation. Alex Morse was elected mayor of Holyoke, a struggling city in the western part of the state, when he was, I believe, just 22 years old. He was going after Richard Neal on all the points that we're used to hearing progressive challengers from the left go after perceived moderate Democratic incumbents.
And just a little background, Richard Neal, a 31-year incumbent chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, like you're saying, really an established Democrat.
Totally, yeah, the consummate establishment Democrat. And he's not signing on to policy proposals like the Green New Deal, a la Ed Markey, for example. Mm-hmm. So Morse tried to make the case that Neal has not leveraged his position in a way that benefits Western Massachusetts. That was something I think Neal was able to push back on pretty effectively. He also tried to cast Neal as too beholden to corporate PAC money. too intent on maintaining the system as it currently is rather than trying to fundamentally change the system. That critique, I think, probably had more heft. It was something that Morris was able to press to greater gain. But as we saw from the results, it wasn't even that close. And I was a little surprised. I had heard from the Neal campaign for a couple weeks before Election Day that they were pretty confident and that while they thought this was going to be a strong challenge, one of the stronger ones Neal has faced, they didn't think that they were going to be in danger of actually losing. I didn't know if that was bravado or a clear-eyed assessment of the race, and it turns out it was the latter.
Adam Riley is a political reporter for the Takeaways Partner Station, GBH in Boston. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
That's our show for today. It's always great to be back with y'all. Remember, you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet me at ArunNYC, A-R-U-N-N-Y-C. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.